On top of all this, we had to keep in mind the resources and budget that had to be committed to our functional commands, such as space and cyber, both important, exponentially growing areas, as well as defending the homeland, which was Northern Command's responsibility. The annual Senior Leader Conference I hosted in October 2019 for all of the DoD's civilian and uniformed leaders was the key moment early in my tenure where we began the arduous task of implementing the NDS, pursuing its three lines of effort, and addressing these issues. The agreed-to top 10 objectives that gave life to the strategy, previously listed in Chapter 4, all touched on China in some way, shape, or form. For many of these objectives, I asked my policy team to take the lead in identifying and shaping sub-objectives. For example, under the top 10 objective to focus the department on China, we developed several tasks that aimed to do just that, beginning with the establishment of a new defense policy office on China and the creation of a China Strategy Management Group to better integrate our enterprise and our initiatives. We also created a new Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for China within policy. A big part of this office's focus was driving initiatives and internal alignment in the DoD. First and foremost, we needed updated and approved war plans to deal with any contingencies that could happen, especially regarding Taiwan. Reviewing and approving the plans prepared by each combatant command is job number one for a defense secretary, coupled with ensuring the forces are available and ready to successfully implement the nation's war plans. The pace of technological and geopolitical change significantly affected the underlying assumptions in our plans, and as a matter of urgency, we needed to rewrite them for our top adversaries. They also needed to be updated through the new, globally integrated and resourced lens we were now applying. The two flashpoints I was most concerned about were a Chinese attempt to seize Taiwan or compel its surrender, and a confrontation in the South China Sea over U.S. military or allied activities in international waters that Beijing considered its own. The particular challenge we face in both scenarios is the ability to quickly build sufficient combat power in each locale to deter an escalation. And if that fails, fighting and winning with such long lines of communication. We started with the planning issue, with my policy team in the lead. This process would continue right up until my final weeks in office, as we went back and forth refining different aspects of the Indo-PACOM plan. Developing a modern joint warfighting concept, JWC, a first step to developing new doctrine, was another critical step. Warfighting doctrine is defined by NATO as the fundamental principles by which the military forces guide their actions in support of objectives. It is authoritative but requires judgment in application. It is an overall conceptual framework that links theory, history, experimentation, and practical exercises to drive initiative and creative thinking in the conduct of military operations. The new American way of war captured in the JWC is known as all-domain operations, and it features using large amounts of AI-driven analysis across the five domains of land, air, sea, space, and cyberspace in milliseconds. Each of the services was also tasked with developing sub-concepts such as contested logistics, joint all-domain command and control, joint long-range fires, and the information advantage. The doctrine I learned as a West Point cadet and Army officer was called air-land battle. The Army developed it to defeat the Soviets on the battlefields of Europe. To this day, I can still cite its key tenets. I wanted that same understanding and emphasis in our professional education for today's force. Air-land battle stood the test of time and was still a credible and effective doctrine, but we needed something new. The simple fact that air-land battle only dealt with two domains, air and land, and today's military was operating in five, air, land, sea, space, and cyberspace, was evidence enough that new doctrine was needed if we were to prevail on the modern battlefield against the Chinese and Russians. General Milley agreed. He grew up in the Army with air-land battle as well. Together, we pushed the Army in 2018 to move forward with a new concept based on multi-domain operations, which would become the centerpiece of the effort he and the joint staff would begin leading to establish a new warfighting doctrine for all of the DoD. I was pleased to learn later that the DoD approved version 1.0 of the joint warfighting concept in June 2021. We also set up a so-called red team led by a capable China hand who would attend all my strategy implementation meetings and offer his perspective on the Chinese view, reaction, or position on any number of matters coming before us. His team's job was to think the way that Xi, the Politburo, or a senior Chinese general would, and then tell us the unvarnished strengths, weaknesses, pros and cons of every critical policy, strategy, and plan we discussed. I relied on this team for their honest assessments and called upon them at nearly every meeting. I routinely received highly classified memos from the Red Team on important technical, strategic, operational, or organizational matters. They involved themselves in all manner of China-related discussions and meetings. Another China focus item was the training and education of our service members on the Chinese military in all our courses. Whether it was a class for new sergeants or a war college seminar for colonels, I wanted the students learning about the PLA as appropriate to their rank and next job. Junior leaders should be familiar with PLA platoon weapons and tactics, for example, while the colonels and Navy captains should be fluent in Chinese strategy. I was pleased to learn in mid-2021 that the Army was making solid progress on a new publication entitled Chinese Tactics, which presented an unclassified assessment of the PRC's military organization, strategy, tactics, and capabilities. This is an example of the instructional and informational materials we need. It was important that we understood a potential foe we hoped to never fight, much like my generation did when we studied the Soviets. I felt so strongly about this as a young cadet in the 1980s that I took Russian as my language at West Point. During the 2000s, many officers studied Arabic. More of our future officers today should be learning Chinese, as well as the languages of our friends and allies in the Indo-Pacific. This was another initiative we worked. As part of our top 10 objective to focus the department on China, I directed the National Defense University to reorient its curriculum by dedicating 50% of the coursework to China by academic year 2021. I wanted the university to become a center of excellence for our most senior officers, the one place they could go to become as expert as possible on China and its military. I also tasked the armed services to make the PLA the pacing threat, the military force against which we needed to organize, man, train, and equip U.S. forces to fight and defeat in our professional schools, programs, and training, including the Army's National Training Center and exercises such as the Air Force's Red Flag. Identifying the PRC as the pacing threat was the right choice, given the effort and resources Beijing was putting into modernizing their military and their warfighting capabilities, and the fact that they saw us as their pacing threat. Even small things mattered when it came to focusing and educating the joint force. We decided to collect articles published in the Chinese media or by PRC-funded think tanks regarding issues in the U.S.-China relationship. These stories were contained under the rubric of Chinese Perspectives in our Saturday morning news clips as another important way to push the China focus forward. My vision was that if the CCP ever decided years down the road that a military confrontation with the United States was the only way to achieve their strategic aims, at least we would have a generation of officers and NCOs across the joint force who understood the PLA and were as prepared as possible to fight, win, and survive on the modern battlefield. While I wanted to be prepared for the worst, I was also committed to working for the best. China does not have to be a foe of the United States. That is not what we should want. Therefore, we had to be careful not to make this a self-fulfilling prophecy. To begin, we often stated that our issues were with the CCP, not the Chinese people. Next, we welcomed China's rise within the international rules-based order established in the wake of World War II. After all, the United States didn't pursue the 1979 opening, the PRC's 2001 entry into the WTO, and everything else in between just so the CCP could tear the system down and rebuild it in their image. But this was now what we seemed to be up against. The bottom line was that the rules-based order that had been in place for 75 years had benefited everyone, and China particularly so, and it would be both wrong and foolish to replace it to benefit one country. I always believed it was important to open lines of communication and build relationships not only with your allies and partners, but also, if not more important, with your rivals, adversaries, and foes. There is no harm done in talking, so I reached out early on to my counterparts in Beijing and Moscow and tried to maintain a pace of meeting or speaking with them every 3 months or so. The Chinese defense minister was a general named Wei Fenghe. He had joined the PLA in 1970 at the age of 16 and rose over the decades to become commander of the PLA Rocket Force, China's version of U.S. Strategic Command. I had first met him at a dinner Defense Secretary Jim Mattis hosted for our Chinese counterparts at Mount Vernon in November 2018. Wei had become Minister of National Defense in March of that year. Though Wei was my nominal counterpart, we recognized that he wasn't truly an equal when it came to authority and power in his own system. Nonetheless, he was my best point of entry, and I was determined to leverage my interactions with him to further our understanding, interests, and competitive posture. While it is always difficult to really size up a person, let alone build a rapport, through a translator, I found Wei to be serious and professional. He was also reticent, but I couldn't tell whether that was his nature or whether he was simply very careful in what he said during our discussions. Our first formal meeting was by video conference, and we met in person again in Bangkok at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Defense Ministers Conference in November 2019. Wei also seemed committed to building the relationship and even invited me to visit Beijing in 2021, which I told him I would do. The important thing was that Wei and I knew each other. We also knew how to get a hold of one another quickly, and we had enough of a relationship and mutual respect to discuss difficult matters. This was critically important should a crisis ever occur. I wanted the ability to pick up the phone, to explain, warn, question, or simply hear him out so that we could clear the air of any misperception or misunderstanding that might lead to an unintended confrontation or mishap. As we delved deeper and deeper into the China portfolio during my tenure, I became very concerned about China's cyber capabilities and their growing space abilities. As a result, we made a number of changes and investments in both areas during my tenure to address them. I was also concerned with China's efforts to modernize and expand the size of their nuclear forces. Beijing was later found to be rapidly building scores of underground missile silos in the country's western desert as it developed its own strategic nuclear triad. The ICBMs that would be placed in these hardened silos would dramatically increase the PRC's number of deployed nuclear weapons, possibly marking a clear shift from Mao Zedong's long-standing posture of maintaining a minimum deterrent against the country's strategic adversaries. Now it appeared that strategy had changed as the size and sophistication of its nuclear forces quickly advanced. We needed much more insight into what Beijing was doing and why. An arms control agreement would give us the opportunity to have these discussions, as well as visit and inspect their nuclear forces, ground, sea, and air platforms, as the Russians and Americans had done with each other for years. Bringing China into the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty with Russia was a good way to do this. Using the leverage of Moscow's desire to extend the agreement was a solid way forward. The Trump administration pursued this hard, but ran out of time, having started too late. It was right to extend the treaty, but I was disappointed to see the Biden administration do so for 5 years, until February 5, 2026, without even trying to get Beijing on board. It was a missed opportunity. When it came to the conventional balance of power between the United States and the PRC in Asia, China had made enormous gains over the previous 2 decades, though we still had clear overmatch in most areas. 2 particular areas stood out, however. One was the PLA's development of land-based ballistic and cruise missiles with conventional warheads. The Chinese had more than 1,200 of these weapons, many with ranges of well over 2,000 miles. This gave them the ability to strike U.S. and Allied forces and bases throughout the Western Pacific. The numbers they had produced and continued to build gave them an advantage in capacity as well that could overwhelm our air defenses. And with the United States constrained from developing comparable systems in the intermediate range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers because of our obligations under the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, INF, treaty with Russia, we were unable to offset their capabilities with our own equivalent forces. In short, the PLA's missile systems were integral to China's anti-access, area denial strategy for the Western Pacific, and constituted a major obstacle for the United States to overcome if we ended up in a conflict with them. I supported the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty in 2019, but not because I'm reflexively opposed to arms control. I had worked these issues for years. Arms control has a role to play in our national security toolkit. In fact, the Department's 2018 Nuclear Posture Review points out that we will seek agreements based on certain conditions, namely, that they enhance security and are verifiable and enforceable. Rather, I supported withdrawal because the INF Treaty had outlived its usefulness given Russia's continued noncompliance, a major reason our NATO allies also supported withdrawal, and the constraints it placed on our ability to address the growing PLA missile threat in the Indo-Pacific, a theater notable for its great distances and wide expanses of water. I was heartened to see in 2021 that the Biden administration supported the position we took on the INF Treaty, as well as the Trump administration's later withdrawal from the Open Skies Agreement with Russia and other countries, also due to Moscow's continued noncompliance. These decisions validated our approach toward not only these agreements, but our broader national security concerns. My first trip as Secretary of Defense was to Australia for the annual 2+2 meeting, along with Secretary Pompeo, to meet with our counterparts and discuss a wide range of issues. China was always a principal topic of discussion. Before departing Sydney for my other stops in New Zealand, Japan, Mongolia, and South Korea, we held a press conference to wrap up our sessions. In the media briefing, which occurred a day after our August 2nd withdrawal from the INF Treaty, I made clear that I wanted to deploy an intermediate-range missile capability in the Asia theater as soon as possible to counter the PLA's advantage. Needless to say, this caught Beijing's attention in a negative way, which told us a lot about the importance of fielding these systems and what doing so meant to them. It was a major reason the DoD decided to invest billions of dollars into hypersonic weapons, new ground-based cruise missiles, and other long-range precision fire systems. My second major area of concern was the PLA Navy. By 2020, China had also built the largest navy in the world, a threshold they actually crossed in 2015. Meanwhile, the United States declined from a high of nearly 600 vessels during the Reagan era to slightly under 300 battle force ships in 2020. Numbers alone, however, do not dictate capability. The United States deploys more tonnage, meaning larger and more heavily armed ships, and outstrips the Chinese Navy 9-1 in vertical launch missile cells. These cells are leading-edge systems for storing and firing a greater number and wide range of missiles, from anti-air to anti-surface guided missiles. These are often the ship's primary warfighting systems when it comes to long-range defensive and offensive weapons. Moreover, the composition of both navies is different. While the PLA Navy has an overall fleet of around 360 surface ships and submarines, the United States has far more aircraft carriers, nuclear-powered submarines, cruisers, and destroyers. The Chinese advantage is in more, but less capable, diesel submarines, frigates, and corvettes. Other measures are also important, such as the skills of one's sailors, the ability to perform joint operations, and experience in conducting sustained deployments. Hence, if given the choice to go with one maritime force or the other in times of conflict, I would go with the U.S. Navy every single time. That said, China's Navy is clearly on the rise. They have been running while we were jogging when it comes to maritime capability, which means at some point they will surpass us in overall warfighting ability if we don't pick up our pace. With significant increases in their defense budget each year, which has seen significant annual growth over the last 20 years, coupled with exceptional shipbuilding capacity and a unified government commitment by Beijing to increase the size and capability of their naval forces, they have advantages that Washington is either unwilling or unable to match. As the DoD's 2020 annual report on China states, in spite of forecast difficulties for China's economic growth in the 2020s, the Chinese Communist Party has the political will and fiscal strength to sustain a steady increase in defense spending over the next decade, to modernize the force, explore new technologies, and ensure it maintains its status as the second largest military spender in the world. Washington's commitment isn't keeping pace in comparison. For example, the PRC's defense budget for 2021 shows a 6.8% increase over the previous year, while the proposed U.S. budget is roughly flat, which actually ends up being a decrease in spending power due to inflation, with some in Congress pressing for a drastic 10% budget reduction. Opponents of increased U.S. defense spending will often argue that America's military budget is more than sufficient. After all, they say, the U.S. defense spending is several times larger than China's. Yet they ignore the details underlying the numbers. What they fail to acknowledge is that while the United States has a far larger overall defense budget, we also have global responsibilities, alliance commitments, and other requirements that drive costs upward and may not be directly applicable in a conflict with China. Furthermore, when you add in costs the PRC's defense budget doesn't account for, such as military R&D, adjust the price of military personnel/labor between both countries, and then norm spending through the lens of the widely accepted purchasing power parity metric, China's defense budget looks far more comparable to ours. Indeed, some reports estimate that Beijing's military budget is about 87% of America's. Beijing has other factors in its favor. For example, a 2018 UN report put China in the top spot with 40% of the world's shipbuilding market, based on gross tons, with South Korea coming in a distant second at 25%. According to another report, between 2014 and 2018, China launched more submarines, warships, amphibious vessels, and auxiliaries than the number of ships currently serving in the individual navies of Germany, India, Spain, and the United Kingdom. As for the United States, we don't have sufficient shipbuilding capacity right now to materially increase the number of warships we build each year, even if we had the money. For the near term, China is building a navy capable of defending the mainland, the water surrounding it, and its excessive maritime claims in places like the South China Sea. This is the crowded waterway in the Western Pacific through which one-third of the world's shipping passes, carrying $5 trillion in trade annually. It also contains major oil and natural gas reserves on its seabed and hosts enormous fisheries that are critical to the food security of millions in the region. And of course, Beijing is building a modern military capable of seizing Taiwan, isolating it, or compelling its surrender. Key to these plans are the long-range precision missiles, coupled with satellites and other surveillance assets that can target U.S. Navy aircraft carriers and other major American warships. By doing so, they put our most powerful vessels at risk, and thus could keep us out of the waters they are aiming to control. Over time, we expect China will build a blue water navy that can take the fight out of the Western Pacific and into the Eastern Pacific, and then globally, from the Persian Gulf to the Arctic, to the Indian Ocean, and maybe the Atlantic, to assert themselves and advance their interests. The future naval force structure called Battle Force 2045 that I presented in the fall of 2020, a year after the 2019 Senior Leader Conference, was designed to ensure the U.S. Navy's predominance for decades to come. As I detailed earlier, it possessed the core operational attributes needed to fight and win against the PRC. These operational attributes include distributed lethality and awareness, survivability in a high-intensity conflict, adaptability for a complex world, ability to project power, control the seas, and demonstrate presence, and the capability to deliver precision effects at very long ranges. And with more than 500 manned and unmanned ships, it would be a more balanced fleet with a greater number of smaller surface combatants and an ample submarine force more than capable of handling the Chinese Navy and the future challenges it will present. As the election heated up in the late summer and early fall of 2020, so did U.S.-China relations. Tensions had been escalating for some time, driven mostly by Beijing's handling of COVID going back to the beginning of the year. There were also sharp and enduring disagreements with Beijing, however, over Taiwan, the treatment of U.S. allies and partners in the region, the confinement and abuse of the Uyghur population in western China, and Hong Kong, to name a few. Defense and state had been leading on these matters for a couple of years at this point. In February 2020, for example, I gave a major speech on China at the Munich Security Conference that hit them hard on several of these issues. President Trump was a relative latecomer to this broad, tough approach. Critics accused him of being soft on human rights issues, taking it easy on China's crackdown on Hong Kong, pulling punches on tough actions against PRC tech giant Huawei, and other things. Indeed, in a rare moment, I saw him chastise Mike Pompeo for being too aggressive in public remarks the Secretary of State made about the PRC, asking Mike to please dial it down as they sat opposite each other across the Resolute desk. Pompeo paused for a moment, acknowledged Trump's request, and nodded in agreement. But as COVID hit the United States hard, Trump finally got more on board with his own policy, as I already stated. He was angry about Beijing's handling of the virus and the impact it was having on America. I suppose it was also easier to blame them for allowing the pandemic to spread in the early days rather than taking responsibility for how he mishandled it over the course of a year. Lastly, he also wasn't going to let Joe Biden outflank him when it came to getting tough on China. The United States government, including me, blamed Beijing for not being more transparent about COVID and not sharing all the information they learned about the virus, its origins, and its spread. Trump brought this up constantly and had been calling COVID-19 the China flu for many months. He also knew that COVID had devastated a great economy and was threatening to undermine both his presidency and his re-election. Over the summer in July, the DoD conducted a dual carrier cruise, meaning two aircraft carriers performing a joint mission in the immediate vicinity of each other, through the South China Sea. These types of operations aren't common, but they also are not unique, just infrequent. This one captured a lot of media attention nonetheless, and a good deal of interest from Beijing and our friends in the region. Beijing saw it as a show of force. We thought the operation demonstrated our capabilities and capacity in the midst of a global pandemic, particularly after the sidelining of the USS Theodore Roosevelt for several weeks in the spring, when some in China believed the virus brought the U.S. military to its knees. But as we entered the most intense period, the final 3 months of an election cycle, I wanted to make sure we were following a more predictable and traditional schedule. Indeed, we organized a secure call with Secretary of State Pompeo not long after the dual carrier operation to discuss these things. During the first week of September, the Pentagon released its annual report on China's military power, which repeated President Xi Jinping's two major goals for the PLA: to complete military modernization by 2035 and become a world-class military by mid-century. The report further added that Beijing's desire for the PLA to become a practical instrument of its statecraft with an active role in advancing the PRC's foreign policy was driving the military buildup. Stories speculating what war between the United States and China would look like began appearing in the wake of this report, further stirring things up. That same month, we started to see more aggressive behavior from the Chinese Communist leadership and the PLA. Beijing was conducting exercises and deploying more ships to the South China Sea to assert its unfounded territorial claims. At the same time, it was flying more military aircraft closer and closer to Taiwan, and with greater frequency. And in the first half of September, China continued its pressure campaign against Taipei by conducting a large-scale air and naval exercise around an outlying Taiwanese island. A week later, from September 18th through 19th, as the highest-level visit by a State Department official to Taipei in decades began, nearly 40 PLA Air Force planes crossed the Taiwan Strait median line, the internationally recognized north-south demarcation bisecting the 110-mile-wide channel east and west between the countries, in a major breach of past practice designed to threaten Taipei. While all of this was going on, we continued to refine our war planning. It was one of our top 10 objectives. On Monday, October 12th, the media reported that the Trump administration approved the sale of several advanced weapons systems to Taiwan. It was something the DoD definitely supported. We were working on new and more ways, many of which became policy, some of which are not public, to cooperate with Taiwan and help improve their defenses. I was also pressing on Taipei to spend much more on defense, and equally important, on the right mix of forces and weapons, the best way to defend against the PLA. China reacted negatively to the arms sales, calling on the United States to cut all military ties with Taiwan, and then promised some type of response for Washington's action if we did not. The next day, Chinese President Xi Jinping visited a PLA Marine Corps base in Chaozhou City, Guangdong Province, and told his troops to put all their minds and energy on preparing for war, and to maintain a state of high alert, according to media reports. Between the public rhetoric going back and forth, private feedback we were getting from Americans who work on U.S.-China issues, and intelligence reporting, it was becoming increasingly clear that Beijing was unsure what Washington's intentions were in the fall of 2020. Was it election year rhetoric? Or were we thinking about provoking a military confrontation? Weeks earlier, James Anderson, Mark Milley, a few others, and I had met with Admiral Phil Davidson at Indo-Pacific Command to better understand his operational, training, and exercise plans over the coming months through the November election. The activities were straightforward, with standard freedom of navigation exercises and aerial surveillance missions planned. The freedom of navigation operations are particularly important. It was the way by which the U.S. Navy asserted the United States' right, and indeed every nation's right, to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. The Navy had done this throughout its history, and it performs these operations today in contested waters all around the world, such as the Persian Gulf. If these operations aren't routinely performed, then it's too easy for a country's baseless legal claims to become a de facto state of affairs. And so, as China's illicit claims increased in recent years, so did U.S. operations. In 2020, the United States conducted more freedom of navigation transits through the Taiwan Strait, a recognized international waterway, than ever before. That said, I wanted to make sure we were neither increasing nor decreasing our operational tempo as we approached November 3rd. Either way could send a wrong signal to Beijing. One event that did concern me in the fall as Beijing became more jittery was Indo-PACOM's plans to deploy larger-than-normal numbers of ships and aircraft, including bombers, into Northeast Asia a week or so before November 3rd in preparation for a long-planned exercise later that month and into December. The early deployment was necessary due to COVID restrictions and quarantine requirements being imposed upon U.S. forces by our foreign hosts. I understood the command's logic in arriving early, but wasn't comfortable with the timing. I thought it would unnecessarily alarm Beijing to see so many additional ships and aircraft heading toward the area just days ahead of a heated U.S. election. As such, I directed the command to delay the force's departure until after November 3rd. My guidance throughout the fall, after all, was to keep our posture and operations steady as she goes. Do nothing more or nothing less than we would normally do, I often said, which included continuing the freedom of navigation operations the Chinese detested, unless some type of external action warranted it, and then we would first discuss the matter. Anything otherwise could send the wrong message to allies, friends, and adversaries in very different and potentially dangerous ways. Despite our efforts, there was still a risk of confrontation due to a misunderstanding or misperception. The last thing we wanted was a situation, for example, where tensions were so high that a U.S. ship and a Chinese one in the South China Sea, or elsewhere for that matter, ended up in a bumping match that escalated into shots being fired. And then where would it go from there? Or worse, the PRC might become convinced that the United States was preparing to take some military action against them. Might they be thinking a wag-the-dog scenario was being considered by the White House and act preemptively? Pursuing a confrontation with China was never discussed at the Pentagon, and I never heard the president even mention such a thing. But the Chinese didn't know that. Our job was to look at the situation not only through our own eyes, but also through Beijing's lens. I sat down with my policy lead, James Anderson, in mid-October to discuss the matter. He had similar concerns given the intel reports, military movements, and escalating rhetoric on both sides. I asked him to send a message to the Chinese from me that we understand that you have concerns and may be confused, but that I wanted to personally assure them that we are not seeking any type of confrontation with the PRC, that the situation here in the U.S. should not be misread. We want to keep the lines of communication between our two militaries open to prevent any misperceptions that could lead to unnecessary friction or conflict. Following my decision to reach out to the Chinese, we held a conference call on October 22nd with Anderson and key members of his policy team, Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence Joe Kernan, General Milley, and Admiral Davidson to discuss a number of Indo-PACOM issues, to include the OSD's private outreach to Beijing. By the time of this secure conference call, James Anderson had come back to report my message was conveyed on October 20th by a civilian political appointee in the policy office responsible for Indo-Pacific security affairs. Anderson said the message was well received by the Chinese and that they thanked us for the clarity. I was pleased by the news. The last thing we needed was to stumble into an accidental conflict nobody wanted, especially with the Chinese. Given this outcome, I asked General Milley to arrange a similar call with his counterpart in the PLA to follow up and reinforce my message, as per our standard practice. Milley agreed. The joint staff faced some coordination challenges, so my civilian OSD staff eventually assisted them in arranging the call. All of this pushed the chairman's outreach back to October 30th. This type of coordinated messaging was common at the Pentagon. In fact, sometimes we calibrated it with our peers in other departments, or tasked civilian and military leaders at levels below me to speak with their counterparts as well. Often, other members of the interagency participated in those calls. However, in late September, apparently the State Department cut off most of its contacts with their PRC foreign ministry counterparts, according to my OSD policy team. This added to the tension and mystery. Days after his call, the chairman reported that his message was also received well by the PLA. They appreciated our reassurance. All in all, I felt my directed message to the Chinese on October 20th, followed by Milley's call on the 30th, was the right thing to do. This messaging was all about promoting strategic stability and avoiding unnecessary conflict. I learned months later through a credible source, however, that Trump was unhappy about my decision. The speculation was that this added further fuel to his desire to fire me. I don't think so, but who knows? And who cares? Better a little careful diplomacy than a confrontation that nobody wants. That was the whole reason I was trying to build a relationship with my Chinese counterpart in the first place, and part of the reason I stayed on board as Secretary of Defense through the election. After 4 years, I felt the United States was in a much better place with China than where we began in 2016. A consensus on China had finally formed. Our country, most of its leaders, institutions, businesses, and others, was moving in a better direction, and it was bipartisan. I was proud that the DoD led this push early on. But it is also fair to say that the coordinated actions of defense, state, commerce, justice, NSC and others, in accordance with our strategy, solidified this sober, clear-eyed assessment of Beijing's intentions. After all, we knew what it would mean for the nation and other Western democracies if we didn't get organized and focused. Fortunately, the president's inattention to the strategy, or his decisions that sometimes seemed to undermine it, weren't debilitating. It was tough to build a collective effort with allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific, and especially so with our European allies when the president was constantly beating them up. It was also difficult to deal more forcefully with your counterparts in Beijing when Trump was proudly citing his personal friendship with the head of the Chinese Communist Party. The president eventually got more on board with his own China policy in the last year of his administration, as I noted previously. We accomplished a good deal by the end. I just wish we had started as robustly as we finished. We would have moved the ball farther downfield if we had. State, Defense and others did a good job emphasizing the importance of arms sales to Taiwan, supporting democracy advocates in Hong Kong, citing Beijing's aggressiveness in the South China Sea and the Himalayas, criticizing the PRC for its genocide of the Uyghurs in Western China, and calling them out for their economic espionage and intellectual property theft. But these actions would have been more effective if we had the full-throated support of the White House and from the president. Maybe more important, we were fortunate that Trump's heated and escalatory rhetoric toward China in the final months of the administration didn't create a fissure in the bipartisan consensus that had formed in the preceding years. It had taken a long time to get there, and it could have quickly unraveled if either candidate decided to take a different approach toward the PRC for short-term electoral gain. Looking ahead, the time has also come for the United States to review our One China policy and the various communiques that undergird it, beginning with the 1979 U.S.-PRC joint communique, and to update the policy. In the 42 years since the United States switched diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing, much has changed within both countries, between them, and internationally, politically, economically, and diplomatically. America's One China policy is no longer sufficient. It has been overcome by history and reality, making it an inadequate foundation upon which to rest such an important foreign policy and its supporting strategies going forward. For example, the government in Taiwan is now not only a thriving democracy, but it also no longer claims de jure sovereignty over all of China, as it did decades ago. Moreover, the PRC has not lived up to its end of the deal. It has used coercion and intimidation to influence Taiwan, as well as other countries that wish to maintain relations with the government in Taipei. This diplomatic, economic, and military bullying campaign has showed no signs of relenting, and the PRC's flexing of its growing military muscle around Taiwan has increased dramatically in the last few years. This was a main reason we strengthened and expanded the DoD's activities with and around Taiwan. Beijing has also successfully distorted Washington's One China policy in the minds of many around the world, including in the United States, to serve their own ends. The fact is, U.S. policy does not accept China's sovereignty over Taiwan, as Beijing would like everyone to believe. Rather, the One China policy merely acknowledges that Chinese on either side of the Taiwan Strait maintain there is but one China and that Taiwan is a part of China. Washington sought to clarify the U.S. position in 1982 and further reassure Taipei by issuing its so-called Six Assurances, but much of this diplomatic history is unknown, misunderstood, or forgotten. A review of U.S. policy toward China and Taiwan should look at the full gamut of issues we now face, and then update that policy in a way that is principled, rational, defensible, and sustainable. A 21st century policy must better reflect our values, such as our commitment to democracy, freedom, and human rights, which inevitably means being fair to the people of Taiwan and their elected government. For example, there is no good reason Taiwan is not a member of the World Health Organization, especially during a global pandemic, or excluded from other important international organizations. An updated policy should better reflect reality when it comes to Taiwan's status, restate the importance of resolving the core issue of sovereignty peacefully, and quickly garner the support of other democracies around the world. The challenging part will be to do this without provoking armed conflict with the PRC. All that said, I walked away in November 2020 feeling good about the DoD's role in this strategic shift and the plans we left in place to keep the department and the nation moving forward. The incoming Biden administration seemed to be saying many of the same things about China that we had during my tenure, and if that continued, and they backed it up with action and sufficient annual increases in defense spending, and maybe even adopted the core tenets of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, I had hope that as an institution and a country, we would continue to improve our position for the challenging years ahead. Chapter 20. America's Strategic Advantage. There is at least one thing worse than fighting with allies, and that is to fight without them, Winston Churchill famously remarked. The key to adequate deterrence in the future, let alone being able to fight and win against China, is not only about building a better military, It is about strengthening our allies and growing new partners, a core tenet of the Pentagon's national defense strategy. Allies and partners are an asymmetric advantage of ours that Beijing cannot match. That's why China and Russia are trying to neuter this edge while they work to build their own sets of partnerships, including with each other. That is my concern when I see glimpses of South Korea's seeming drift closer to the PRC, or when Southeast Asian countries with long-standing ties to the United States hear the siren song from Beijing, tugging at them with promises of economic and military assistance. In my view, East Asia was becoming the epicenter for great power competition, if not geopolitical instability, in the world. Nowhere else but in this region, from North Korea to Taiwan, are the stakes higher, the players bigger, the situation more complicated, and the game more intense. This part of the world contains four of the world's nuclear-capable states, three of the world's largest economies, six of the world's largest or most capable militaries, and a half dozen of the world's most technologically advanced countries, all within relatively close proximity, if not missile range, of one another. Conflict in East Asia would have a devastating global impact, even if the war itself is confined to the likely flashpoints of the region. The U.S.-Japan alliance is the linchpin of the post-World War II security framework in the Pacific, and critical to ensuring stability in East Asia. Approximately 50,000 U.S. military personnel are stationed in this maritime nation, the highest number of permanently based service members in any one foreign country. And when you include their family members and other Americans employed there by the DOD, the total is nearly 100,000 people. Their purpose is to ensure the theater remains free and open by providing a ready and lethal capability that deters adversary aggression and enhances regional peace and security. Post-war bilateral relations between Tokyo and Washington have generally been strong and relatively immune to noticeable swings one way or the other, as sometimes happens between the United States and other allies. Moreover, according to the Government Accountability Office, GAO, Japan pays about 38% of the cost to keep U.S. forces in Japan, while nearby Seoul pays around 30% of the bill to keep 28,500 American troops in Korea. However, while South Korea spent a healthy 2.7% of its GDP on defense, Tokyo spends no more than 1%. I thought it should be at least 2%. This was an issue I would often raise with the Japanese given the increasing challenges we faced from China, especially in the East China Sea. For nearly my entire tenure, Japan's Minister of Defense was Taro Kono, an established and capable politician from the Liberal Democratic Party, who has been a member of the House of Representatives since 1996. Kono comes from a well-known political family in Japan and earned his college degree from Georgetown University in the United States. Kono spoke very good English, which, when coupled with his keen intellect, affability, and good sense of humor, made him a great partner. Kono had worked in Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's cabinet in several roles, including a stint as foreign minister before becoming defense minister in September 2019. During the year or so that we worked together, we engaged on a range of issues that had long plagued the U.S.-Japan relationship, such as the U.S. Marine Corps presence on Okinawa, including the relocation of U.S. Marine Corps Air Station Futenma from Ginawan to a less densely populated part of the island, and Japan's efforts to complete the purchase of Magashima Island, an uninhabited outcrop located a little more than 20 miles from the southernmost Japanese mainland of Kyushu, to support aircraft carrier landing practice. I also thanked him for Japan being such a gracious host to U.S. forces for so many years and reiterated our commitment to working with and engaging the local communities where we stationed our troops. But the bigger issues dealt with international challenges, such as the relationship between Seoul and Tokyo, policy toward North Korea, strengthening the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, building the Quad, and tackling the long-term challenge of China. We would meet whenever possible to discuss these issues, whether in Tokyo, Washington, Bangkok, or Guam. When it came to North Korea, Tokyo had serious cause for concern. Pyongyang's missiles could easily range Japan and had been shot into Japanese waters and over one of the country's islands in the past. It was very threatening, especially given the historical animosity between the two peoples since Japan's harsh colonial rule over the Korean Peninsula from 1910 to 1945. I always thought that if war erupted on the Korean Peninsula, one way or another, Japan would end up having missiles fired in its direction. And given North Korea's unpredictable nature, we had little idea if these would be conventional weapons or a missile tipped with a weapon of mass destruction. As the United States entered into discussions with North Korea, it was important to keep the issue of ballistic missiles in mind for these reasons. It wasn't good enough to simply prohibit the North's work on ICBMs. We needed to proscribe missiles of all ranges for the sake of both Seoul and Tokyo. In addition to the missile and nuclear programs of North Korea that all countries were concerned about, there were matters of unique importance to Japan, principally the abduction of Japanese citizens by the North beginning in the late 1970s. North Korea admitted to some of these criminal acts, but not all of them, and Tokyo was fully committed to resolving the cases. This was another issue always atop the list of items we would discuss bilaterally, and that the United States would commit to putting on the agenda of any talks between Washington and Pyongyang. Japan was also a critical player when it came to enforcing UN Security Council resolutions sanctions against North Korea, disrupting Pyongyang's illicit ship-to-ship transfers of prohibited goods, and hosting other countries who were supporting UN activities. It was a team effort to keep the pressure on the North and get them back to the negotiating table. Finally, there was China. There was no disagreement between the United States and Japan on Beijing's intentions and plans, or the importance of us standing up to them together. Beijing clearly wanted to dominate the Western Pacific and control the sea lanes, which in and of itself was a threat to Japan's sovereignty, security, and economy. But to do this, China needed to secure the so-called First Island Chain, which is a string of islands enclosing the Chinese mainland that arcs southward from the Japanese home islands through the Ryukyu Islands, Taiwan, and the Philippine archipelago. This chain represents a geographic barrier for entry or exit into Chinese waters, and its control is critical in times of conflict. Securing their illicit claims to the many islands caught behind this first island chain and then defending them is a major reason Beijing is building out its navy. While the PRC's excessive claims in the South China Sea are often the talk of most countries, it is their claim over the Senkaku Islands, which are under the administration of Japan, that concerns Tokyo most. The Senkakus are a group of uninhabited islands in the energy-rich East China Sea, located northeast of Taiwan and west of Okinawa. In recent years, Chinese ships, both fishing vessels and Coast Guard cutters, have increasingly entered the waters surrounding the Senkakus to push their claims and test Tokyo's mettle. Illegal fishing by China and the harassment of Japanese fishermen in the area is not uncommon. PRC Coast Guard ships have also increased their incursions into Japan's territorial waters. Upping the ante, Beijing recently approved a law for its Coast Guard allowing their ships to take all necessary measures, which could include using force, to prevent foreign ships from operating in Chinese-claimed waters. Japan's Coast Guard did a good job pushing back on these incursions, but it was important for me to also affirm publicly Washington's commitment to defending the Senkaku Islands, pursuant to Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. We also expressed our opposition to any unilateral attempts, meaning by Beijing, to change the status quo in the East China Sea. It was for all these reasons that Kono and the Abe government were thinking more strategically and more assertively about how best to deal with a rising China. This included collaborating on and considering various PRC Taiwan scenarios, something we should do more of with our regional partners. China was not just another country that also harbored deep resentment toward Japan because of its own occupation at Tokyo's hand in the first half of the 20th century. It was now a major player inclined to ignore international rules and norms and to use its economic and military might to bully and intimidate others, and eventually dominate Asia. My last meeting with the Japanese defense minister would be in Guam in late August 2020, not long before Prime Minister Abe stepped down and Kono got caught up in a cabinet reshuffle. We were able to discuss several specific items that really showed the increased seriousness with which the Japanese were taking China, including joint war planning, gaming, and exercises. We talked about various ways we could improve interoperability between our forces, particularly when it came to air and missile defense, as well as for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance functions. Finally, we discussed COVID, how to protect our respective armed forces, and then how to make sure we blocked the CCP's efforts to wield the pandemic as a diplomatic weapon against us in the region. Beijing was working hard to paint the United States as a declining power with a dysfunctional political system. In their view, Washington's handling of the pandemic, as compared to Beijing's, was another instance that showed China's single-party communist model was better and more effective than a multi-party democracy. The sidelining of the USS Theodore Roosevelt in the Pacific due to COVID was an example they used against us. In the meantime, they were backing up this rhetoric by offering medical supplies and PPE to countries around the world. Kono and I agreed, as did our other regional partners, that we needed to do everything we could to counter this nefarious information campaign. When it came to security in Northeast Asia, the other critical ally was the Republic of Korea, ROK. The U.S. relationship with South Korea, as the country is more commonly known, was strained by the rhetoric coming out of the White House, however. Over my 3-year tenure at the Pentagon, this dynamic and the issues we faced on the peninsula would become a particular concern to me. Both the United States and South Korea faced an ongoing threat from North Korea and a longer-term strategic challenge from China. I was confident our views regarding Pyongyang were aligned, but I worried that Seoul was drifting into Beijing's orbit, drawn in by the gravitational pull of trade, economics, and geography. The critical issue was whether South Korea would select China as its economic partner of choice while trying to maintain the United States as its security partner and hope that both approaches are compatible. They aren't, of course, yet this seemed to be the path they were headed down. The immediate issue facing Washington and Seoul was North Korea. In the last 2+ decades, Pyongyang's development of nuclear weapons and long-range missiles that menaced the ROK were now a threat to the U.S. homeland as well. As such, our first task was enforcement of all UN Security Council resolutions as we pursued an agreement that would ensure the complete, irreversible, and verifiable denuclearization of North Korea. At the same time, the horrible plight of the North Korean people and the oppressive prison state in which they lived was something none of us could ignore. More broadly, I saw the alliance as critical to the larger Indo-Pacific region and our evolving posture toward China, even if the North Korea problem disappeared overnight. Both countries are important reasons for maintaining a U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula. However, we seemed unable to resolve several issues with our ally despite expending a great deal of effort. North Korea's missile tests in the first half of 2017 prompted the United States to deploy its Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, THAAD, anti-missile system to the southern part of the Korean Peninsula as a defensive measure to thicken the existing missile defense architecture. The THAAD system was capable of detecting and intercepting missiles that could threaten South Korea, our troops on the peninsula, and even parts of the United States. China reacted angrily following the announcement of THAAD's deployment in 2016. Beijing believed the system's radar threatened its own security by being able to track military movements within China. The PRC is South Korea's largest trading partner, so Beijing put an extraordinary amount of economic pressure, in addition to diplomatic arm-twisting, on Seoul to cancel the deployment. Beijing went so far as to cut international flights between the two nations and reduce the number of Chinese tourists visiting Korea. The decrease in tourism alone reportedly cost the South Korean economy billions of dollars. South Korean President Park Geun-hye stood firm, however, as the United States installed the first THAAD systems in April 2017. The PRC and ROK began patching things up after that, but Beijing had made its point. Over time, it seemed as if Seoul was gravitating more and more toward China, seeking its favor. Was this real or perception? Was it a function of new Korean President Moon Jae-in's government, or was a more fundamental shift underway? This was when our concerns emerged that South Korea might try the impossible by siding with China as its economic partner while relying on the United States for its security. I visited our troops at the THAAD site in 2018 as Secretary of the Army, and their living conditions were terrible. I raised this issue with our South Korean counterparts repeatedly, both as Secretary of the Army and Secretary of Defense. We attributed Seoul's inaction to domestic politics and excessive concern about China. Each time I pressed the matter, my Korean interlocutors asked for more patience to find a solution. At our last gathering at the Pentagon in October 2020, I raised my voice in anger over the issue. After more than 3 years and no visible progress, my patience with their stalling had run out. In the large Nunn-Lugar conference room that day, I sat across the table from my counterpart, with our aides flanking us on both sides. I spoke for several minutes, loudly and sharply, looking up and down the table at my Korean allies, who sat stone-faced. I recounted how I visited this site 3 years ago and it was in bad shape then. I was told to be patient because you were working on it. I added, when I raised this matter again the following year, I was told the same thing. This is not how allies treat allies. This is not how the military takes care of its people. To make it more personal, I asked, would you be happy if your sons and daughters lived and worked in these conditions? The air grew thicker with tension. As the Korean delegation sat there trying to figure out what was going on and how to react, I went on and on about the matter. I finished by turning to General Milley, who nodded as I said the following. Chairman, I'd like the joint staff to conduct a study that assesses the impact of withdrawing THAAD and presents other options for performing the mission off the Korean Peninsula. I'd like that in 90 days. This really got the Koreans' attention, as I expected. Milley responded with a quick and eager, yes, sir, will do. And that was that. I folded my arms across my chest and gestured for the defense minister to respond. My performance caught our Korean counterparts off guard. They sat stoically but uneasily in their chairs throughout my monologue and were now dumbfounded about how to respond. I probably shouldn't have done it. It was not diplomatic, but I felt for our people on the ground, and I had been pressing this matter for years. I needed to shake the Koreans up. After all, our soldiers were not only protecting the United States, they were also defending South Korea. The least our hosts could do was treat them properly. I hoped my outburst would spur them into action. The early reports back told us that it did. Another major issue, which began in 2018 and bubbled over in the summer of 2019, was the deteriorating relationship between South Korea and Japan, and the effect it had on our collective deterrence in the region. It was frustrating to see these two long-standing allies of ours squabbling between themselves as North Korea tested ballistic missiles and developed nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, Beijing went about flexing its muscles in the waters of the East China Sea and beyond. Even Russia benefited from this dispute. Domestic politics prevented Seoul from containing the matter, the result of a long and horrible history, and impacted the ability of the United States, Korea, and Japan to work more closely together to improve our collective security. In August 2019, Seoul announced it would not renew an agreement with Japan to share military intelligence. The two nations had signed the pact, known as the General Security of Military Information Agreement, in 2016, as tensions with the North were escalating. An important part of the arrangement was the quick, seamless intelligence sharing it facilitated, especially when it came to urgent situations, such as the launch of ballistic missiles out of North Korea. The dispute emerged after South Korea's Supreme Court issued rulings in 2018 that Japanese companies must compensate victims of forced labor dating back to Japan's occupation of Korea in the first half of the 20th century. This infuriated Tokyo, which believed the matter had been settled decades earlier. Japan reciprocated by imposing export controls on Korean chemical exports and taking other actions aimed at the ROK economy. Things continued to escalate from there. In the grander scheme, however, both sides were losing, as was Washington. North Korea benefited from all this internecine fighting, as did China. President Trump would see all of this and shake his head in disgust, questioning again the value of these great allies, as he would say sarcastically. I was in the Indo-Pacific region again in November 2019 on a long-planned trip anchored to the ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting Plus in Bangkok that month. The purpose of my trip was to get to know our ASEAN partners better, strengthen our defense ties, and to work with them on a meaningful code of conduct regarding maritime behavior in the waters of the region. We were pressing for an agreement that would reinforce the international laws, rules, and norms that ASEAN members and the United States considered essential, and which Beijing was actively working to undermine. China was present too, but rarely mentioned, let alone called out publicly, in these discussions. In some ways, it didn't matter. Everyone knew China was breaking the rules, and that they were our focus. The silence of most countries, however, demonstrated the extent to which they were cowed by Beijing's quiet strong-arming. This was my second trip to Asia in 4 months. I had been to Japan and Korea in August 2019 when the intelligence-sharing dispute was brewing, and raised the matter then on visits to each capital. I stopped in Seoul again before heading on to Bangkok to discuss several issues with my counterpart, to include the intelligence-sharing arrangement. At breakfast, before the start of our business day, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs, Randy Shriver, suggested an alternative approach when I met with President Moon later that day. He sensed that asking Moon to reverse himself on the arrangement might be politically difficult, if not impossible, but suggesting they suspend their decision might be the face-saving way out. This made sense to me, and I saw no downside to proposing it, as we were getting closer and closer to Moon's deadline. I offered this framework to President Moon at our meeting, and he seemed to absorb it without making any commitment on the spot. But sure enough, hours before the agreement was set to expire, the South Korean government announced it would conditionally suspend the expiry of the intelligence-sharing agreement. A good lesson learned about getting to yes in Asia. In all my meetings in Seoul, I also raised the issue of burden sharing. South Korea was a wealthy country, one of the top 12 global economies. It wasn't fair to ask them to pay for everything. After all, our forward deployment on the peninsula was about U.S. security and interests, too. However, Seoul could afford to pay more. Estimates from my team at the DOD were that the ROK was covering no more than one-third of the costs most directly associated with the stationing of U.S. forces in-country, a figure corroborated by the GAO at around 30%, as mentioned earlier, such as the employment of local workers and payment for housing that went back into the Korean economy. According to the U.S. ambassador in Seoul, many in South Korea mistakenly thought these funds went to the U.S. Treasury. I thought the starting point should be 50%, far less than what President Trump was demanding, but a more equitable place to begin given the challenges we jointly faced. It wasn't worth breaking the alliance over, or even publicly threatening to do so, but with Koreans paying roughly $924 million annually out of a $1.6 trillion GDP, Seoul could afford much more. We never reached a final agreement on this in 2020. The Koreans dug in. On one hand, they felt the United States had negotiated in bad faith, Shriver told me. After a year of talks, Seoul had agreed to an increase proposed by the U.S. side, only to have President Trump undermine his own negotiators and reject it at the 11th hour. On the other hand, South Korea also had legislative elections coming up in April 2020, and President Moon couldn't afford to look weak. However, as insulted as they were by Trump demanding a 400% increase in burden sharing to $5 billion annually, Korea failed to see how the 13% increase, about $120 million more annually, they proposed that spring was equally insulting to the White House. This made it really difficult for alliance proponents such as Mike Pompeo, whose State Department had the lead on the talks, and me to find a reasonable solution. With a lapsed burden-sharing agreement in 2020, U.S. Forces Korea was out of money by April 1st to pay for the approximately 9,000 Korean nationals working for the DOD there, as well as logistics support contracts necessary to sustain readiness. To continue to provide our troops and families with workers who supported their life, health, and safety functions, as well as essential logistics, I directed the U.S. military to pay for about 4,200 of the employees' salaries and about $70 million in logistics support. This was an unforecasted bill that affected the services, but we could not leave our people hanging in the wind. States supported this action. Issues like these would rile Trump up. He would complain that the South Koreans were horrible to deal with and pressed multiple times for us to withdraw U.S. forces. Much like his views toward Germany, he believed South Korea was ripping us off. He constantly cited the trade imbalance, saying that they sell us Samsung TVs and we protect them. It makes no sense. I would have to explain how the U.S. presence in Korea is important not only to South Korea but to America as well. We had important interests in keeping a check on North Korea, which had developed the means to threaten the U.S. homeland. Our presence there helped make sure that Pyongyang didn't do anything stupid. That said, while I was pleased to see the Biden administration agree in early 2021 to a new special measures agreement with Seoul regarding cost sharing, I still believe we should continue to push for a more equitable burden sharing. The U.S. presence also stabilized the broader region and helped build the sinews between Seoul and Tokyo that would be so critical in case of a conflict on the Korean Peninsula. The Moon government seemed far more willing to set aside differences and talk with North Korea, however, than with the Japanese. This was a problem. It flared dramatically in the summer and fall of 2019 over intelligence sharing, as previously discussed. Trump would point to these tensions and say that South Korea wasn't serious about its security. "Why are they fighting with Japan?" he would ask. Great question. North Korea was an immediate problem for the United States, Japan, and South Korea, but to me, how our three nations worked together to deal with China in the coming years was the bigger issue. Our bases in both countries were great locations to position American forces as we looked ahead. For these reasons, I became very uneasy when Trump talked about the need to pull all U.S. forces completely out of Korea. I was able to make my best case against any such moves by reminding him that I had a global posture review underway, which I did, but that only bought me time. Pompeo jumped in once to help, saying, "Mr. President, you should make that," withdrawing U.S. forces from Korea, "a second-term priority." This placated him. Trump responded with, "Yeah, yeah, second term," as a Cheshire Cat smile came across his face. I knew, however, it was something I couldn't implement. South Korean domestic politics seemed to be spilling over into other parts of the security relationship as well. The liberal Moon government was hell-bent on assuming wartime operational control of Korean troops during the ROK president's term, which ends in 2022. Since July 1950, the United States has been responsible for control of all forces on the peninsula in the event of war, though the Koreans have a much larger role in that today. However, South Korea wants to be in charge of all troops in the theater if war breaks out. It is a creditable approach, and one the U.S. supports, but it should happen only once the South Korean military is ready. If this transition occurs any sooner, it could harm our joint warfighting effectiveness, which is critical to our deterrence of North Korea. Operational control transfer was a legacy issue for President Moon, but one that made no strategic or operational sense to rush. We had agreed years earlier to pursue a conditions-based approach whose first principle is to strengthen the alliance's combined defense posture. The first condition requires the Koreans to acquire a number of specific critical military capabilities. Other conditions imposed similar mandates and called for a series of military assessments. There are other issues as well, and South Korea is behind on many of them. As Secretary of Defense, I met with President Moon on at least two occasions at the Blue House, his official residence and executive office, to discuss this and other issues. The Blue House was large and ornate, with a broad wooden, winding double staircase covered in bright red carpeting that led to the second floor, where we usually met. Unlike the White House, the Blue House was quiet and serene. Aides were not running about, as happened continually in the West Wing. When our muted conversations paused as we awaited our escort, you heard nothing but silence. The large room where we met the South Korean president was decorated with a gold-colored tapestry on the wood walls and a beautiful cream-colored carpeting on the floor. Two rows of square, dark wooden chairs were arranged on opposite sides of the room, facing one another about 25 feet apart so that each cohort of aides could see the other. We usually stood in front of our chairs for a few minutes, awaiting the president's arrival. This gave both teams a few moments to greet one another or finish any conversations. The president would arrive quietly, with no fanfare. He greeted everyone in the room and then took his seat at the front, between both rows of chairs. My seat was located to his right, with a small table between us. Moon has a quiet, cautious demeanor. Smart, well-informed, and engaging on policy, he occasionally revealed an easy sense of humor with a quick smile as the conversation played on. Moon was elected president in 2017. His foreign policy aligned with his liberal predecessors by adopting a stance toward North Korea that was softer than that of his political opponents. Regarding the United States, he was once quoted as saying, "I'm pro-U.S., but now South Korea should adopt diplomacy in which it can discuss a U.S. request and say no to the Americans." His policies and actions during the Trump administration clearly reflected this more independent, if not distancing, stance from Washington. I shared with President Moon the U.S. position, and frankly the view of his own armed forces, that we must continue with the approved, conditions-based plan for OPCON, operational control, transfer. Too much was at stake, I conveyed in diplomatic terms. Our joint capabilities are what deter North Korean aggression, I added. If we ended up in a conflict with Pyongyang, we needed to have the most effective command and control system and leadership in place to defeat them. For all of the progress the South Korean armed forces had made over the years, they simply weren't ready to assume operational control. Moon always listened intently and nodded politely, but the president was on a timeline he wanted met by the end of his term in mid-2022. In a private meeting with the new South Korean Minister of National Defense, Sa-uk, in October 2020, we discussed this issue at the Pentagon. He was a very professional and capable former general who did his duty, proposing that... Text redacted. I shared with him my personal commitment to our alliance and to improving our combined defense posture. All of this meant we must continue following the long-agreed-upon process. We raised other issues as well, the responses to which led me to conclude that, for as much as the political leadership above the Ministry of Defense talked a good game about readiness and jointness, they weren't fully committed to making the hard decisions needed. Fear of domestic political blowback was too great. Whether it was improving living conditions for our troops at the THAAD site or supporting our live-fire training requirements in-country, we faced a variety of challenges that affected our readiness. This political atmosphere created a headwind for other things I wanted to do. For example, I was eager to make changes to our posture on the peninsula that would upgrade our readiness and capabilities, such as replacing many of our permanently based fourth-generation fighters with fifth-generation F-35s. Although I was told... Text redacted. General Abrams, the four-star commander of U.S. Forces Korea, supported getting these advanced aircraft into Korea, especially since the Korean Air Force already had 20 F-35s in-country. Abrams liked this idea but thought it would be a political and diplomatic bridge too far, not to mention how North Korea might react. However, I believed this was also manageable if done collaboratively and over time. I proposed instead that we not permanently base the F-35s in Korea, but that we rotate them every 6 months or so back and forth from different units in the United States. A side benefit, I added, would be that we could keep the crew's families in the States, where they had more stability, including better access to jobs for the spouses. Also important, more U.S. Air Force squadrons would get greater exposure to flying in-country with the Korean Air Force. This is what we were doing with the Army's Armored Brigade Combat Teams, and it was working out fine. This was a major change for General Abrams to digest, and I'm sure it would have been triply difficult for the Moon government. Nevertheless, Abrams went to work looking at options and variations of options. He was scheduled to brief me in early December 2020, but of course that was a few weeks after I unceremoniously left the Pentagon. That said, the politics in the United States at the time weren't right either. With Trump pushing to remove U.S. forces stationed abroad, as he did regarding Korea on many occasions, too many people would have immediately pointed to the White House, cried foul that we were abandoning our ROK allies, and then put up every means of resistance to the DOD adjusting our force posture. Yet, all I would have been seeking to do was improve the overall readiness of our fighter squadrons, bring an advanced capability in the F-35s to the peninsula, and give our Air Force families more stability. I also wanted to implement some of the new deployment concepts we had developed as part of the National Defense Strategy. The key to peace and stability on the peninsula and an acceptable resolution of the situation there is strengthening the alliance and our combined defense so that diplomacy can succeed as the only credible path forward. This will be challenged, though, as long as these U.S. ROK issues linger. Even with these matters hanging over us, U.S. and South Korean defense cooperation remained robust, especially at the uniformed level. I was always confident we were ready to fight tonight, as we would often say, to defend our values, our interests, and our nations. Also important, however, is the continued cooperation among the United States, South Korea, and Japan based on our common security interests, especially when it comes to policy consultations, exercises, and information sharing regarding Pyongyang, Beijing, and other regional challenges. Along these same lines, it is essential that South Korea join the Quad. Doing so would not only broaden the grouping as we work to strengthen and deepen it, but would also send the right signals to many other countries, especially Beijing, about Seoul's geopolitical position. And beyond our collaboration in conventional areas with these countries, we need to do more together more quickly in the space and cyber domains of competition and warfighting, as well as against the gray zone operations by China. These were the things I raised with my Japanese and South Korean counterparts, including the centrality of leaving history to history and focusing on the future if we are to be successful. During my nearly 18 months as Secretary of Defense, I was able to build other important relationships in the Indo-Pacific through visits, phone calls, and side meetings at regional forums. I would rack up well over 225 meetings with partners from more than 60 countries around the world, but our focus was Asia. In most of these countries, I was also able to meet with presidents, prime ministers, emirs, and kings alike to discuss geopolitics, regional threats, and our bilateral security relationship. Our counterparts were always pressing for a greater U.S. presence, more collaboration and joint exercises, and ironclad commitments to assist in their defense. The importance of American leadership and presence around the globe was rarely more palpable than when I met with our allies and partners, especially those who faced real threats. The Defense Minister of New Zealand, Ron Mark, was a pro-American former Special Forces officer who welcomed me on my arrival in Auckland in August 2019 with a traditional Maori hongi greeting, my first ever. Ron was a good partner who leaned forward on issues, which I liked. In Singapore, Ng Eng Hen is an accomplished surgeon with a wonderful sense of humor who became Minister of Defense in 2011. It didn't take me long to also figure out that he was a wise and extraordinary statesman. And Delphine Lorenzana, the Secretary of National Defense of the Philippines, was a retired general who served in that nation's army from 1973 to 2004. He was also a good partner who had trained at some of the same U.S. Army schools I had years earlier, which facilitated an easy rapport and a good relationship. I was also able to visit or meet with partners in Vietnam, Indonesia, Mongolia, Thailand, and Palau, not to mention phone calls I had with other defense ministers and heads of state in the Pacific Island countries, a long overlooked but critical set of relationships. It was an important part of our strategy to strengthen these partnerships. The good news is that countries in the region were largely aligned with us, but seeking greater engagement from the United States. Each conversation had a few common themes: concern about China's plans and ambitions, unhappiness with the PRC's military, diplomatic, and economic bullying, a desire to work more closely and often with the U.S. armed forces, and usually in their country, and a genuine hope that Washington would continue to challenge Beijing and lead in the Indo-Pacific. The disappointing news was that these partners were reluctant to speak publicly about China's bad behavior or stand up to them in multilateral forums out of fear of the PRC's intimidation tactics. While there are notable exceptions to the rule, these countries tend to speak out only when parochial interests are challenged, and rarely about the overall threat to the free and open order from which they benefit. This is why U.S. leadership was and remains so necessary. Earlier in the summer, in June 2020, the so-called 5i partners of Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States held a virtual summit to discuss the challenges facing the region, with a focus on the pandemic. Our discussion centered on how best to help other countries in the Indo-Pacific while also countering the CCP's continued bad behavior and negative COVID diplomacy. Virtual 5i meetings among defense ministers were an important development that should be continued beyond the demands of the pandemic. Holding such a meeting semi-annually, if not quarterly, would be another way in which we could keep ourselves aligned and advance important initiatives to address the PRC. Linda Reynolds, the Australian Defence Minister whom I met during my first trip to Sydney in early August 2019, organized the first virtual meeting. Linda was a wonderful counterpart who was fluent on all the issues. She and her foreign minister seemed to make a great team. During the year, in between our annual summer meetings, we would often call or text each other. As a result, we became friends as well as colleagues and had the benefit of our spouses befriending one another as well. Reynolds' idea for a virtual Five Eyes meeting was brilliant. It was a good way of getting us all together without the challenge of busy schedules and long flights one way or the other. We all agreed on some basic steps we would take together when it came to COVID and China. I also mentioned our continued commitment to conducting freedom of navigation operations in the Western Pacific, especially since Beijing was planning large-scale naval exercises in the South China Sea in the coming months. We wanted to make clear not only to these partners but to all our allies and partners in the region that the U.S. Navy was ready and on station and welcomed their participation in these operations as well. One of the most important relationships we worked to grow was the one with India, the largest democracy in the world. The U.S.-India bilateral relationship was one the United States had been building for years through Republican and Democrat administrations alike, and at least as far back as my third stint at the Pentagon from 2002 to 2004 when I was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration. My first job at the Pentagon was as a war planner on the Army staff from 1995 to 1996, as previously discussed. I count as my second stint at the DoD my work as a major in the National Guard, performing weekend and some weekday duty at/for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Special Operations/Low-Intensity Conflict in the 2001 timeframe. For more detailed information on my life and career, please visit my website. There were a lot of sound reasons for Washington and New Delhi to be close partners. Two important democracies, shared values, a common respect for the rule of law, and a large and successful Indian diaspora in America. Geostrategically, we have common interests in matters ranging from improving energy security and defeating Islamic radicalism to the future of Afghanistan and, most certainly, the rise of China. But the history of relations between our two countries still acted like a brake on our efforts. At the time of India's independence from the United Kingdom in 1947, many prominent Indian leaders had positive relations with the United States. The Truman administration also favored India, viewing it as a better long-term partner than Pakistan. But India's neutral stance wasn't received well in Washington as the Cold War heated up. So in 1954, the more pro-U.S. Pakistan became an American ally under the Central Treaty Organization. In response, to offset the growing U.S.-Pakistan ties, India pursued a relationship with the Soviet Union. India later became a founding member of the Non-Aligned Movement in 1961 in an attempt to avoid taking sides between the United States and the USSR during the Cold War, but too many in the United States still viewed New Delhi with suspicion. President Kennedy saw things differently, much like American leaders do today, with India as a strategic partner to offset the rise of China. As such, the United States publicly supported India during its 1962 border conflict with the PRC, flying in arms, ammunition, and equipment for the Indian military. With Kennedy's assassination in 1963, however, relations cooled again for decades. It wasn't until 1991, with the collapse of the USSR and the end of the Cold War, that U.S.-Indian relations started warming and allowed for a more natural order of things to develop. The relationship accelerated during the presidency of George W. Bush and maintained a solid pace during the Obama era. The rapport between Washington and New Delhi would reach a new level during the Trump administration. One of the newer and more substantive developments in U.S.-India bilateral relations was the establishment of the annual 2+2 meetings between the foreign and defense ministers of both countries. We held the first one of these in India in July 2018.